Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. It was Charlie Munger who once said, the big money is not in the buying and the selling, but in the waiting. I'm Jimmy Mayaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest board appointments for the South African Post Office. We speak to the Minister in the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies and get a sense of what these latest appointments mean for the state of the South African Post Office. We have a conversation as well with the team at Worksmen's Attorneys, taking a look at the pressures that businesses are facing as more than 800 businesses have entered business rescue or liquidation since the start of this year. We speak to Dr. Eric Levenstein, Head of Insolvency and Business Rescue at Worksmen's, and get a sense of what's driving some of these challenges for businesses and how businesses can navigate them. Then we have a conversation with our Aviation Specialist Managing Director at Plain Talking, Lyndon Burns, on the state of the aviation sector in South Africa and on the African continent ahead of the Avia Dev conference that is taking place or set to kick off tomorrow in Botswana. We're going to get a sense of what to look forward to there and what the state of the South African aviation is at the moment. We wrap up the show with a property conversation. We speak to the Chief Executive Officer of Pam Golding Properties and get a sense of what young buyers might be looking at the moment as housing prices continue to grow higher.
The day's markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
As always, that's where we kick off the show with a sense of some of the market movements that have been unfolding throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by Taylor Ginsberg, local equities analyst at Umthombo Wealth, to take a look at markets, see what to make of them. Taylor, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. A better day on the equities front today, if we look at some of the movements that have been unfolding. It has been kind of an up and down period still from an equity market perspective, but markets this week having to contend with strong economic data out of the US last week and still seemingly finding good footing to get into the week.
Yes, the markets, I have to agree, they have been quite mixed, and certain sectors have done better than others. So I see the bond market has done quite well today, and that's off the GDP news that was released this afternoon. And so shares that have been linked to that, generally what are called bond proxies, namely real estate, have done relatively well this day. And I see generally a lot of SA Inc, finance, and the mining stocks have generally been down at close.
Talia, when we look at local markets, the resource stocks are still down, but financial stocks having a fighter of a day if I look at just how far up they moved on the day's trade. Industrial stocks coming to the party as well, about a tenth of a percent up. But I suppose the big question there is what seems to be driving the confidence in financial stocks? We know we got that ratings upgrade from Fitch on Friday, and perhaps the market is starting to be a bit more optimistic. Financial stocks have always historically been a good proxy of confidence, particularly in our own local markets.
Yes, sorry, actually, just to clarify that before I said they were down, no, they're actually up of now. As I said, I think it is because of the that GDP read that came out. I suppose they're also a proxy for financial, particularly banks, very much I've seen a good see through for the economy. But however, we are just talking day-to-day trade, and so it's hard to separate what is a real trend and what is just white noise.
Talia, let's look at that GDP print in a bit more detail. Surprising to the upside, beating estimates ever so slightly, 0.5% from a numbers perspective, but the broader sense of the South African economy. It has been a constrained economy. We have been struggling for a couple of years. We did see a bit of green shoots towards the tail end of last year. It's nice to be able to see that momentum carried into Q1, at least, of this year.
Yes, I agree. This would technically mark a sixth consecutive quarter of growth, which I suppose, as I said, given our economy was Quite a pleasant surprise. And these results, I'd say they're encouraging. They're not through the roof. South Africa would need to see a lot more growth in order to grow jobs and things like that. But we are seeing some nice green shoots, particularly from agriculture, was really the big pusher there, up 3.9% this quarter. Some push from finance, which has been quite, the financial sector has been quite consistent, and even things like logistics, transport, your basics doing quite well. You're talking about before the consumers being constrained, and we can see that in household spending, certain things they spend is down in beverages that contracted in things like hotel and leisure, and so there's still a bit of pressure from the consumer and also from businesses. Still, we should. It would be good to see more fixed capital investments and stronger manufacturing.
$89 a barrel. That is the oil price that I'm looking at right now on my screen. I didn't think we'd break $90 a barrel this week. I want to get your thoughts on this, Talia, because if we break below this, we would have effectively broken below levels that we last saw, or we haven't really been able to break below this level sustainably since the initial ceasefire was declared. And if we are able to hold below this $89, we could be in for some really good relief at the pumps when it comes down to fuel decisions. Am I being very optimistic here? It's still very early in the month.
Sure, this isn't exactly a topic that I love to speak about, and the reason is that it's so linked to geopolitics, and so far it's been so linked also to sentiment. I mean, Trump puts out a tweet, and that can set the direction of the oil price just for the day. And so, yes, obviously everyone wants a lower oil price for various reasons, which would be good for the economy. But I think, as I tell people, you have to see, I would have to see concrete evidence in order to get excited. Today, there has been some relief, as they said, that there's been some halt on the fighting. But personally, I would need to see concrete evidence of any kind of end to the conflict going forward.
Oh, and we absolutely know that this conversation could take a very different turn by the time you and I are done on the phone, simply because, as you rightly mentioned, President Trump could open his Truth Social, he could open his social media, and we could have a very, very nasty conversation by the end of the evening. This is, I
Yes,
suppose,
it's still daylight in America.
absolutely so many hours left, and even then, we still don't know what's going to come of that. Let's
Yeah,
take a look at
exactly.
the Rand, Talia. The Rand holding its own against the US dollar, against all of the major currencies at the moment. 1650 against the US dollar, very struggling with that level. It's coming below, it's trying to come below, it came below last week, but thankfully it isn't going above 1650 at this stage.
Yeah, the Rand, it's been surprisingly resistant the past couple of months, and there's various reasons for that. It has gotten a support from, generally speaking, it's had good support from the commodities. We're seen as a commodity currency, and so the higher gold and platinum prices have given it a good floor. And then even today we see that today, as I said, a better print. We've had better bonds prices today, a stronger bond yields today. And then also I think in terms of the perception of the currency, we are seen as having quite a strong institutions, namely the our Reserve Bank, which is, they raise interest rates, which perhaps isn't great for people who own a loan, but it's seen as quite offensive for the rand.
Talia, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts around where the risk sits at the moment in the markets. We've seen lots of volatility on the commodities front. We've seen some up and down movements that you and I looked at on the equities front. But something you alluded to at the start of our conversation is that with sentiment being so uncertain, markets are kind of very up and down on the trading side of it. Where do you think the biggest risk sits, other than the glaring conversation around the Oval Office?
Where don't risks sit in the market? So, and I've been speaking to my industry peers, and it's been a, I'm sure you've picked up too, it's been a tough time, and it's been a tough time. And so I'd say the macro story is, I mean, just looking globally, I'd say the macro story is not very encouraging. Higher energy prices, there's going to be lower manufacturing, lower productivity in economies, higher inflation. And so unfortunately, the macro story that is unfolding this year doesn't, or at least since end of February, doesn't seem very promising.
Lots to still be concerned about, but it seems that markets are finding a way to contend with the volatility and the risk that is out there. We'll see for how much longer this is able to go on. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Equities analyst at Umthombo Wealth, Talia Ginsberg, joining us to take a look at markets and share her thoughts on some of the driving factors.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm at Atlanta Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe. Will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The South African Post Office has a new board. The board has been signed off and put in place by the Minister of the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies, obviously the stakeholder in this case on behalf of that state-owned entity. We're going to be taking a look at this. We're going to be taking a look at the implications that come with a new board with the minister himself. Minister Solly Malatsi joins me on the line now to see if we can make sense of the post office at the moment. Minister, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Can we perhaps start with an overview of where the South African Post Office sits at the moment? Our understanding, of course, is that we've been in business rescue since July of 2023. The new board has now been appointed. Where is the Post Office in terms of what's been reported to you?
Good evening, Jimmy, and to all your listeners. Indeed, the Post Office has been under business rescue for roughly the past 3 years. And where it is now, like many state-owned enterprises, it is confronted with serious liquidity challenges. Those are very well documented. And particular, given what were the contributory factors leading to where the business rescue process initiated, is that the post office, due to either a combination of historical underinvestment, historical mismanagement, and a sense of historical, lack of focus, meant that it did not invest in the digital infrastructure that it needed in order to catch up with the evolution that happened, particularly in the postal and courier services market, which, as you can tell by now, through the mushrooming of private players in the space, shows that while there is a market for that, the post office, due to the reasons I alluded to earlier, struggled to remain reliable, competitive in that space. And naturally, where there is an unreliable service, customers move, and that has been the challenge for the post office.
Minister, take us through the latest round of board appointments for the post office. You would obviously have to sign off on that as the stakeholder in question here. Can you give us a sense of the board that's been put in place here and what the the mandate that you've given to the board as the shareholder is?
Yeah, so I think it's important to start with the process. We initiated the process towards the end of last year. It was widely publicized, including, you know, in all prominent media and the Government Gazette, because that's how the process unfolds. And we embarked on a very rigorous process of obviously not only doing the shortlisting, but you also have to do background checks. Then the internal government process, which once as the Department of Communications were finished with, you know, doing the shortlisting and recommendation, we have to seek cabinet concurrence or cabinet approval. That process at cabinet level culminated last week with the approval that the cabinet provided for the post office to have a board. And it was important to move towards having a board because it is one of the necessary preconditions in exiting business rescue. The other precondition was a projection that at least for a period of a minimum of 6 months to the foreseeable future, the liquidity of the post office, seems intact. The immediate mandate of the board would be looking at establishment of sustainable private partnerships. It is quite clear that the state no longer has the means to continuously keep making, you know, massive capital injections into state-owned entities that are not financially sustainable on their own. But secondly is the principled view that, you know, these entities themselves also have to have a commercial model that would reduce the over-reliance on the state for funding and financing. Because the truth of the matter is, if you look at the history or the size of bailouts that have been injected into state entities in the past 10 years, that figure is very astronomical. And in fact, it takes away from, investments or allocations from social welfare or education and crime fighting activities, which are necessary for the country to keep a track on.
Minister, can we look at that bailout conversation in a bit more detail? I understand that, of course, parts of this predate your appointment potentially as minister. We know that where we stand at the moment, business rescue practitioners have said we need at least 3.7 to 3.8 billion rand to be injected into the post office if we are to see it come out of business rescue. We know at the same time, National Treasury has said they are not going to be putting in almost 4 billion rand to get the business out of business rescue. What does that mean for the post office financially? You alluded to the fact that the new board must come up with a commercially viable model. Does this mean until that happens, we stay in business rescue?
No, and that's the point that I was making earlier, that the appointment of the board is part of three preconditions to exit business rescue. The priority right now is towards exiting business rescue, and in fact, the business rescue practitioners will be officially filing for that exit. It becomes necessary to have a board when you exit business rescue because there must still be a governance structure that is responsible for conducting the oversight of the entity, providing the strategic leadership for the entity, and also holding the management accountable for the execution of the mandate of the entity. The conversation around the billions that you are referring to emerges from the steps that were taken at the very beginning of, you know, the attempts to prevent the post office from getting into liquidation, which is why the sixth administration then took the view that it should be put under business rescue. There was an indication that in order to successfully complete the business rescue process, an amount of over 4.8 billion would be needed. That amount, which was a projection, the government immediately injected around 1.6 billion at the time. And there was a plan which, you know, the business rescuer put in place of an amount of 3.2 billion, which would be needed to successfully get out of that. But of course, the Treasury correctly felt and was of the view that that allocation would need to be supported by a very credible plan for the sustainability of the institution and also on private partnerships, and also taking into consideration the reality of competing interest that our fiscus is currently under. And as a result, the 3.2 billion conversation is actually closed because you know, there is no provision for that, and the state has no means actually to be able to get to that. It is for this reason that part of our interventions was in last year, December, when we published the request for expressions of interest in order to invite proposals for private players who would want to, you know, play a role in partnering with the post office so that we can leverage those partnerships towards the salvaging the sustainability of the post office.
So, Minister, what we're saying at the moment is that we're going to rely on our successes in the public-private partnerships that we've seen of late between other state-owned entities, that type of model, as opposed to seeking another 3 billion rand from the state to get this business back online.
Correctly so. I mean, what I'm underscoring is that we have and are imagining and approaching the future of the post office without any expectation whatsoever that there would be an injection of 3.2 billion. Because as I've said to you, the primary you know, requirement for that from, you know, National Treasury's perspective is also the availability of a credible, you know, sustainability plan, a credible partnerships program, which will leverage, amongst others, the property portfolio of the post office and its strategic presence all over the country. And the fact that, you know, there has to be a model that shows sustainability. The fiscus is under massive pressure, Jimmy, as you can imagine, and the competing interests are constantly growing, and there has to come a time where a principal stand is taken around whether you continue, you know, injecting into state-owned entities that are not, you know, sustainable, or rather redirect those funds towards investment in getting more police officers on the ground, in ensuring that there are more teachers in classrooms, and making sure that we can expand the reach of our social welfare program. So this isn't just about what is convenient or needed for the post office or for the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies, but also the fact that we operate within an ecosystem, and that ecosystem unfortunately does not have, you know, endless pockets.
Minister, before I let you go, I want to take a look at where the post office then fits into your portfolio. It has become a broadening portfolio with the introduction of things like digital technologies and the conversations we're having with the likes of Starlink and wanting to improve accessibility in South Africa. The post office, of course, maintains a unique advantage in how it is positioned in the country, how much it has in terms of infrastructure to be able to service those underserviced areas. But is there a place in modern day South Africa for the post office as we knew it, or is it time for us to think about the post office differently?
Look, I think what is necessary is that there has to be a balance between ensuring that there is universal access to postal and courier services, particularly for poor people who mainly are based in rural areas, who are mainly black people in this country, who are, you know, far away from, you know, urban nodal points where there are alternative accesses to that market. I think think the key factor is, you know, the market, the private sector market has shown that the adoption of, you know, digitization brings convenience to the end user, in this case, the customer. And customers want a reliable service that is affordable, one that is accessible, and that they can enjoy with ease. And that is where the post office should be competing and thinking about. I think historically there's always been this type of mentality that simply because, you know, an institution is a state-owned institution, it is therefore then entitled, you know, to be the first point of preference for the market. But the reality is that isn't the case. It's competing with, you know, private, and competition is good because competition drives improvement in the quality of service, including also in the determination of pricing.
Competition is good, and the post office as we know it may be completely different to the business that comes out of this business rescue proceedings. We look forward to seeing where this new board and their mandate takes the post office in terms of the strategic direction of that business. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thank you to Minister in the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies, Minister Solly Malatsi, for joining us to take a look at the new board appointments at the post office and what it means for that SOE.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's time to have yet another uncomfortable conversation around companies and their health, particularly in South Africa. We've seen an increase in the number of companies that have been filing for business rescue. At the moment, a little over 1,400 companies are reported to be in business rescue, depending on where you are getting your data points from. And more than 50% of those companies are filing from the Gauteng province. We're going to be taking a look at this and what businesses might be facing as challenges with the head of insolvency and business rescue at Worksmans, Dr. Eric Levenstein. He joins me on the line now to see if we can make sense of this. Dr. Levenstein, always lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. You and I have spoken about this in the past, that it's natural for businesses to experience trouble. It's natural for business rescues to occur. We've seen everyone from private businesses all the way to state-owned entities going through business rescue proceedings. But it seems as though this problem is a growing problem.
Yeah, Jimmy, I think it really is a staged process. I think most companies start off their trading life in a fairly positive way, and then there might be disruptors. Now, we've seen, obviously, this year, fuel price increases, massive pressure being put on companies, particularly those in the logistics sector, maybe the courier sector, fuel prices impacting food supply and the like. Now, really what you're looking at some point there's going to be a disruptor, and the question will be, how does the corporate react to something like massive fuel increases and price increases, which affect the way they do business. Now, not only are you talking about companies filing for rescue this year, Stats South Africa reported that 891 companies have entered liquidation in 2026, and about 233 just in April alone. So you can see there remains pressure on the economy and in turn pressure on corporates and on management and directors to survive and to be able to continue to trade on a solvent basis.
Dr. Levenstein, can we take a look at perhaps some of the factors that are leading to these increased business rescue filings? Companies are all different. Companies will operate in different sectors, but surely there are some commonalities at a base operational level that might point to why companies might be going through these.
So there's two forms of distress and where companies start struggling. One is the operational side of the business, and the other would be the financial side. Now, obviously, fuel price increase is systematic. It underpins logistics of companies, distribution, production, manufacturing costs, and service delivery across all sorts of sectors of the economy. So that would be something that would place pressure both on an operational side and on a financial side. And the question simply is for management and directors to understand, if they look some kind of crystal ball gazing into the future, is there a line of financial distress that they're not going to be able to cross? And if that is the case, then they will need outside intervention, advisors, either from their accounting companies or firms, or maybe from their legal advisors. So it's about being mature about decision making and being able to be flexible when it comes to disrupting factors like fuel price increases, like the rand and the US dollar exchange rate. So it really is very much ad hoc. Each company gets affected differently. The question simply is, how does the board and management react to the distress?
Dr. Levenstein, let's take a look at some of the external factors that might be putting a bit of pressure on businesses. There have been global supply chain disruptions as a result of the ongoing wars and escalating tensions throughout the world. And I can imagine there are some businesses that operate on very fine margins with very little wiggle room. How have external factors been behind some of the driving factors that businesses have, or that have led to businesses potentially filing for business rescue?
So when it becomes more and more expensive to trade, companies then have a problem from a cash flow perspective, an ability to pay their creditors on time. You might be on 30-day terms, you might be on 60-day terms, and you might be pushing more and more beyond those timelines. And that's when businesses begin to stretch creditor payment cycles, rely more heavily on their bankers, or let's say their overdraft facilities, or even short-term facilities. So there you've got mounting pressure on the ability to deliver profits and to deliver to your shareholders. And that's really where you find distress, and where companies and directors start saying to themselves, if we continue to trade on this basis, we might be in fact trading in insolvent circumstances. They might get extremely nervous about that, and that's really where they require some form of intermediary advice, and particularly when it comes to personal liability of trading in those circumstances. So there's a whole lot of cost increases which will push a company, as I said earlier, either on the operational side or on the financial side, into a position where they require some form of intervention. And it might be bringing in a chief restructuring officer. It might be bringing in or consulting with a business rescue practitioner. And at worst, it might in fact be a filing for liquidation. So each company is different. Each has different pressures. The question is, how are the board and the management advised by their, let's say, legal advisors and financial advisors?
Dr. Levenstein, let's take a look at that advice and take a look at companies that might already be in distress and looking to climb their way out of distress. For business rescue proceedings, for this process that takes place, the aim of the process is to change the course of direction of the business. But part of that sits within managing the business going forward. There comes a time where business rescue practitioners, legal advisors, restructuring officers have to step away, and the business has to ultimately stand on its own. What would be the best advice to give to a business that is in distress, that is looking to make key changes to never be in distress again?
Well, the business rescue practitioner would play a major role in directing the company towards a restructuring plan that makes sense, that has the support of stakeholders, particularly lenders and creditors, and where it pushes the company towards a better way of trading. Now, that might mean some form of retrenchment of employees. It might mean a change in management, maybe even a change at board level. Maybe, for example, in a retail environment, you might need to cut down on your footprint across the country, maybe close certain stores, make sure that the profit-making stores remain open, as we've seen, in, for example, in the Edcon business rescue. But really what you want to do is the practitioner wants to deliver a plan which is supported by all the stakeholders, which is voted in and approved, and then the rescue practitioner will implement that plan and hopefully after a period of time file for what they call substantial implementation of that plan and then exit. And hopefully the company will then be able to stand on its own two feet and continue to trade on a solvent basis into the future. To me, that's the objective of business rescue. And that's not something which is peculiar to South Africa. It's a system that applies across the world. And with our Chapter 6 business rescue legislation, we have the opportunity to buy in to that process and make it work effectively.
Understanding how business operations work and potentially putting in place measures and systems to prevent business distress, that is how you avoid business rescue, and that is also how a business comes out of business rescue if they happen to fall into that. We're going to have to leave the conversation on that note. Dr. Eric Levenstein, Head of Insolvency and Business Rescue at Worksmans, joining us to take a look at the rise in the number of businesses filing for business rescue and how businesses could potentially navigate these challenging times.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The world of aviation has been going through some interesting challenges of late, particularly some centered around the developments in the Middle East that have created operational challenges such as fuel shortages in all of the aviation sector. But alongside that, well, there's been a need to update and upgrade the infrastructure that we have in some of these areas. We've taken a look at this in the past where it relates to the likes of ATNS and the aviation navigation systems. We're going to be taking a look at another area that needs to be addressed from an aviation perspective and what needs to be done there. I'm joined on the line by our resident aviation expert and managing director at Plane Talking, Lyndon Burns, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Lyndon, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The current conversations and the current landscape in aviation, take us through where we sit at the moment, particularly in Africa and in South Africa. I imagine that some of the challenges that the aviation space faces on the African continent might not be the same necessarily as other parts of the world.
So let's give you a quick global picture, and then we'll put, because that'll give us some good context for Africa. So we've just had the latest revised outlook for 2026 from the International Air Transport Association. This came out over the weekend, and they're expecting the net profit margins for the entire industry will be halved this year, coming down from about 4% to 2%. It's already lower than, you know, last year it was at 4.2%, and they're expecting net profits per passenger transported to be around $4.50. which is half of what they did last year, which was $9.10. Now, I think most African airlines would be smiling if they were looking at 2% profit margin, and if they were looking at a profit margin per passenger of $4.50. In Africa, we're looking at a net profit margin for the entire industry in the continent of 0.2% and a profit per passenger of 40 US cents. So that, you know, it's a huge, huge drop. And what does that reflect? You know, we've got not just thin margins and low profitability, but we've got the highest unit costs in the world in Africa. Double the industry average. A lot of that is to do with fuel, but also to do with perceived risk and the association of, you know, of what that means in terms of finance and insurance. But we're also in a market where, and certainly in a place like South Africa, airlines are generating revenue largely in rand, but incurring their costs in dollars. And every time there's a negative movement and the rand devalues or loses ground, that gap between the two widens and it becomes a bigger challenge for airlines to cover. And typically items including your aircraft, or if you're not purchasing your aircraft, your lease costs, financing, your insurance, your fuel, your spare parts, all of those are incurred in dollars. And if you're operating anywhere else in the region, a lot of countries around us will charge you for fuel in US dollars, not in Zimbabwe dollars, for example. So we've got that. Then we've got a global supply chain crisis, which is affecting all airlines around the world. There's a huge shortage of new engines. It's delaying the delivery of new aircraft. It means airlines that have got aircraft at the moment are keeping them in service for longer, having to spend more money on maintaining older airplanes that are less fuel efficient. So the average fleet age is getting older. And in Africa, where we've traditionally relied on acquiring aircraft that were perhaps pre-owned, that might be 6 or 7 years old, and getting those in the lease markets, we're now right at the back of the queue. And it's become very tough for a lot of airlines to get their hands on more modern equipment. So again, that pushes up their operating cost. There are some airlines that have been successful, but those are airlines that are largely privately owned and that have got strong balance sheets. Then we're dealing with a small market, lower demand in absolute terms, and it's a fragmented market. And why is it a small market? A lot of people ask the question, well, you know, Africa is going to represent a quarter of the global populace by the end of the century. And why do we only represent 2% of the total global market share for air travel? And it's a very valid question, but the answer lies in the low per capita income we have across the continent, the low propensity of most people to travel by air. And, you know, in the words of our own transport minister when she was talking in Parliament the other day, air travel is a middle class travel choice, she described it as, which I think is a problematic definition, but that's obviously her perception. So if we want to address this and we want to increase that demand, increase that volume and grow the industry, we need to raise that per capita income, improve that propensity to fly. And that requires far more aggressive economic policy and action on the part of governments. You know, we're seeing it in our own country. All of these things are intertwined. Unemployment, the tensions about immigration, these all interplay with each other, and they all impact on tourism, they impact on trade, on investment within the continent. We talk the big talk about Africa Continental Free Trade Area and the Single Africa Air Transport Market. 10 minutes ago, I was just talking to an advisor for one of the big global aircraft manufacturers who's asking me, well, you know, what is this that we're hearing about tensions between Nigeria and South Africa? And how's that going to play out on the industry? And, again, this is just to show you how nothing is isolated. All these things interplay with each other.
Lyndon, I want to get your thoughts on how we improve the conditions in the aviation space. It's clear that the cost of aviation is not going to get cheaper anytime soon. It's clear that the demands that are being placed on the aviation sector are not likely to let up anytime soon. But it is also clear that we cannot have a situation where we don't have an aviation industry in South Africa and on the African continent simply because we haven't found solutions here. How do we fix this problem?
So the obvious solution, the first one to look at, is lowering the costs. So where are those costs? Airlines can only lower costs to a certain extent, but if you looked at the breakdown of your ticket, your airfare is a certain amount, and then you can probably add a third to, if not another 50% on top of that, in terms of all the charges and taxes that get applied to your air ticket, which are statutory charges in various countries. So, you know, let's look at those. Are we getting good value for money out of those? You know, are the organizations that are applying those taxes and charges, are they being as efficient as they should be? Whether it's your air traffic navigation service, which, you know, it has a shortage of resources, and therefore we see congestion in the sky instead of smooth flow of traffic. We see queues of aircraft on the ground with their engines burning fuel at 2,000 rand a minute of fuel consumption, or in the sky sitting in holding patterns because there aren't enough air traffic controllers or because flight procedures haven't been maintained by the relevant authorities. So are we getting all of those benefits? And I think all of those different role players in the value chain need to take a long, hard look at themselves and say, what can we be doing better to reduce our costs? How could we be more efficient as well? Because airlines, as I said, you know, they can do as much as they can, but they're not the only piece in that equation. And I think that's really, you know, the biggest pain point. Then you've got some countries in the region like Zimbabwe, Angola, Mozambique, which are making it incredibly difficult for airlines to fly into those countries because they're preventing airlines from taking their revenue out of the country in hard currency. So if you're a South African-based carrier and you're operating flights in Mozambique, you really struggle to get your revenue from your sales out of that country because they have a shortage of forex reserves in those countries. So they're stopping multinationals taking their money out. That's also a big hindrance because if airlines can't access their revenue, they can't cover their costs. And then the obvious choice is stop flying or stop flying to those markets. So you've got a whole lot of moving parts. Safety is another big one. You know, Africa still has the highest accident rate in the world. It's improved significantly over the last 20 years. It's a remarkable improvement, but there's still a lot of room for improvement. A lot of that is down to the way in which incidents are reported, investigated. There are a lot of issues in that in terms of the quality of work, because accident and incident investigations are all about learning and being able to tell industry and operators, right, you know, to avoid a similar incident from happening, this is what you need to do, or this is what we need to do, what we have to put in place. But if the reporting is not good, or it's not timeous, or it's poorly written, you know, then that becomes valueless, and we end up still with a high accident rate and a poor safety record. So those are crucial things. And a lot of, again, I come back to the other issue, which is around the perceived risk profile of African airlines. and of African governments, frankly. You know, we need to be doing a lot more work to promote ourselves as sophisticated, dynamic, agile, smart, you know, good, reliable operators and regulators as well.
Lots needs to be done if we are to get the aviation sector on the African continent to be globally competitive, and this comes ahead of the Avia Dev 2026 conference taking place in Botswana from tomorrow. Lyndon Burns, Managing Director at Plane Talking, joining us from the conference to share his thoughts on how it is that we get Africa's aviation sector back on the right track.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is Property Tuesday time, and we're going to be taking a look at some of the increasing property trends that have been emerging in the market, particularly as it relates to the driving factors behind higher housing prices and what's been driving some of that growth. Joined on the line by the Chief Executive Officer at PAM Golding Properties, Dr. Andrew Golding, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Andrew, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The property markets, particularly from a residential perspective, has undergone quite a lot in the last couple of years. I'm thinking about everything from the semigration trend to the coast to the reverse semigration back up in inland. Where does the property market sit at the moment from a residential point of view?
So I think we find ourselves at an interesting juncture. Our market is very influenced by interest rates. And so although the market is resilient, the fact that we just had an interest rate increase is definitely going to affect sentiment. But having said that, I think the general fundamentals in the market are good. And in particular, we've got a young population that is hungering in terms of getting onto the property ladder. And that's one of the biggest strengths of our market. So there are a number of positive factors in our market, and you know, all things considered, depending on what happens in the balance of the year from a macroeconomic point of view and also locally, it's going to be a very interesting market to try and predict what's going to happen.
Andrew, if we think about the market dynamics at the moment, we've seen quite a bit of a change in perhaps some of the participants, some of the buyers. We've seen an average increase over the last couple of years from an average or from a first-time buyer basis. But we're also seeing that there is a portion of younger buyers that are now accessing the market. How is that trend playing out? Do younger buyers perhaps have different preferences? Do they have different things they're looking for in homes?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, you know, the South African market is very difficult to generalize around because there are so many different subsets. And first-time home buyers are definitely one of those. They've got very specific needs and wants in line with sort of general global trends around lack of commuting time, ease of work, play, and live commodities. And also obviously geographical preferences, but we've definitely seen an increase in first-time home buyers. We've seen the average age of property owners come down, and the average age of first-time buyers is now 35, with the median age of South Africans being 29. So I think that signals a very powerful trend in terms of long-term demand for housing.
Andrew, you've been in the property game for quite some time. Many people might not know this, but you took over the reins of PAM Golding Properties, I think, if I'm not mistaken, exactly 30 years ago this year.
That is correct.
You've seen the property sector in many different shapes and forms. At the moment where the property market sits at the moment, is this the healthiest the market has been?
No, so I wouldn't say that. I think that the market is characterized by so many different factors. If one, you know, looks at the Western Cape market, one can draw a specific conclusion. If one looks at the Gauteng market, you know, one could easily say that it has bottomed out, and certainly the signs are extremely positive that the Gauteng market is recovering extremely well. I think the jury's out on the extent to which the Western Cape market, as an example, is going to continue to just keep going in its direction. Generally speaking, property markets don't just keep going in one direction forever. And so different markets in different parts of the country. I think that generally speaking, though, we've seen a market characterized by a shortage of stock, buyers looking to buy in different parts of the country. And so generally speaking, that is a positive trend. But everything really depends on interest rates. And for as long as consumers are under pressure in respect of interest rates, that's going to put pressure on the market. But on the other hand, if there is some relief in terms of interest rates, I think that immediately translates into sentiment, which results into activity in the market.
What are some of the driving factors that are contributing towards the higher pricing point of view, or the growth in the pricing of houses? I mean, we know that property prices do tend to generally, by and large, especially over the long term, follow an upward trajectory. But we have been seeing that it seems to, there seems to be a bit more momentum in terms of average price or growth in average price. Is that down to some of those factors that you alluded to around perhaps demand in certain areas? Are you noticing anything specific that might contribute towards these increased prices?
Yeah, so I think it's a couple of factors. I mean, fundamentally, it's about supply and demand, and there certainly is significant demand in a number of parts of the country that's being driven by lifestyle issues, by the relative desirability of South Africa relative to what's happening in the global world. We've certainly seen this demographic environment in terms of first-time home buyers creating demand. So, you know, generally speaking, the fundamentals in our housing market are actually really strong. And look good in terms of the medium to long term. It's just a case of needing to understand what's going to happen in the short term, because we are so influenced by what's happening in the rest of the world and also in terms of our own economy.
Andrew, I want to get your thoughts around how markets start to almost self-correct. This is something you and I looked at when we were looking at the semigration trends, and we were looking at the increase in property prices in areas like Cape Town that were outpricing the rest of the country by a significant portion. But as you and I are having this conversation, it sounds very much like certain nodes and certain areas then start to become attractive again, I suppose, maybe due to other areas becoming unattractive from a price point. How does the property market, especially from a residential perspective, start to almost self-correct and create new opportunities for buyers?
Yeah, I think it's exactly that. We've seen that in South Africa, and we've certainly seen it in many different locations across the world, where certain areas become simply unaffordable to certain parts of the population, and that results in a different perspective in terms of other areas. And those areas suddenly start to develop. We see increased investment. We see speculative investment in terms of investors going into those areas first, and that starts to then build out that node, and we suddenly see significant house price growth in those areas. And, there are a number of examples of that around the country, and there'll continue to be more.
Andrew, as part of what might be one of the largest real estate companies that we have in South Africa, and as part of an international business, what has you hopeful about the South African market as compared to perhaps some of the other areas that a business like Pam Golding might service?
Yeah, so I think the fundamentals, as I said earlier, in the market are really strong. I think the fact that we've got a significantly growing middle class, which is creating demand in the market and who are looking to push upwards in terms of the property ladder, as well as the first-time home buyer market, I think that's really a significant plus factor. And then at the very top end of the market, we've got this highly desirable product, which is desirable to high net worth South Africans, but also increasingly to high net worth international purchasers who are bringing foreign direct investment into the business, creating into the country and creating jobs and creating an increase in the economy generally.
The housing market is experiencing growth, and perhaps growth in areas we might not have previously been looking at. This only bodes well for long-term property investors, and could mean that now might be the time to be considering your property needs if that is something you've been looking or eyeing out in the market. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note, though. Thank you so much to Dr. Andrew Golding, Chief Executive Officer at Pam Golding Properties, joining us to take a look at the trends that have been driving the growth in home prices and what we can make sense of.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The Property Pod, hosted by me, Suren Naidu, is South Africa's premier property investor podcast. On this weekly MoneyWeb show, we gain insider insights from leading executives, analysts, developers, and entrepreneurs in the country's dynamic real estate sector. The podcast features diverse guests and offers in-depth coverage on the South African property scene, also featuring as a video on MoneyWeb TV on YouTube. Listen to the Property Pod weekly on moneyweb.co.za, podcast platforms like Iono, Spotify, and Apple Podcast for the latest industry insights and developments.
That's the show for today, folks. If you've missed the conversations, you can catch up on them as podcasts online. It is coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Coase is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.